Hello, everybody, and welcome in to eBible Fellowship's continuing Bible studies into the book of 1 Samuel, heard at this very same time, Monday through Friday. And we thank you for being with us wherever you are and however you're listening to us, either through eBible Fellowship's webcast audio or through Skype or perhaps through Pal Talk or even over the phone. And we pray that the Lord's blessings will be with us over the next 30 minutes or so as we now prepare to open our Bibles and introduce Chris McCann. Good evening, Chris.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our ongoing study in the book of 1 Samuel. This is study number 36, and we're presently in 1 Samuel chapter 2. And I'll read verse 12, and then after commenting on that verse, we'll read the next several verses and then move on as we continue to look into this chapter. Now, 1 Samuel 2, verse 12 says, "Now the sons of Eli were sons of Belial. They knew not Jehovah." And this word Belial is a word that we encountered in chapter 1 when Eli had thought that Hannah was drunken as she was praying and her lips moved. And she said to Eli in 1 Samuel 1, verse 16, "Count not thine handmaid for a daughter of Belial." And then at that time we looked up that word and we saw that it's a word that has a very negative connotation. It involves the ungodly. Actually, it's translated as ungodly in 2 Samuel 22, verse 5. And it's also translated as wicked in Deuteronomy 15 and verse 9. And so this is about as bad of a statement that could be made about anyone to be said that they were ungodly or wicked. They were sons of Belial. They were not children of God. They were not faithful men at all. And the next part of verse 12 confirms this. They knew not Jehovah. They did not know the Lord. And if they didn't know the Lord, then certainly they were not saved men. They were unsaved individuals, and you know, the Bible tells us the truth. And Eli was functioning as a high priest of Israel. He had the oversight over the house of God in Shiloh, over the Ark of the Covenant. He was the authority in Israel when it came to spiritual matters. And certainly he knew himself of the teachings of the Word of God. And yet his sons were not saved. And we can't fault Eli because his sons weren't saved. Actually, later Samuel himself will have sons, and they also do not follow in their father's footsteps, as Israel at that time is demanding a king. And Samuel was a very faithful man of God, but no man, no father can impart salvation to their own children. However, each father is responsible for bringing the gospel faithfully, for telling their children and being an example of a believer to their children. And that's where Eli was at fault. And later in this chapter, God will specifically point that out to Eli, that his children were ungodly, and Eli bore some responsibility in that he did not raise them as he should have. And so here we see, as God wants us to know very absolutely, that the sons of Eli were not true believers. And now let's read verses 13 through 17 of 1 Samuel 2. And it says, in beginning in verse 13, and the priest's custom, and this, the priests are referring to Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of Eli, and the priest's custom with the people was that when any man offered sacrifice, the priest's servant came while the flesh was in seething, with a flesh hook with three teeth, a flesh hook of three teeth in his hand, and he struck it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the flesh hook brought up, the priest took for himself. So they did in Shiloh unto all the Israelites that came thither. Also, before they burnt the fat, the priest's servant came and said to the man that sacrificed, give flesh to roast for the priest, for he will not have sodden flesh of thee, but raw. And if any man said unto him, let them not fail to burn the fat presently, and then take as much as thy soul desireth, then he would answer him, nay, but thou shalt give it me now, and if not, I will take it by force. Wherefore the sin of the young men was very great before Jehovah, for men abhorred the offering of Jehovah. And God here is giving us a couple of examples of the unfaithfulness of Eli's sons as they were priests. They were sons of their father, and the priesthood was a family affair. It ran through the tribe of Levi, through Aaron. And so Eli was a descendant of Aaron, and so were his sons. And they became priests of Israel. And you know, this actually is helpful, that God gives us the spiritual condition of Eli's sons. They were Israelites. They were true Jews, physically descendants of Abraham. They were true priests, descendants of Aaron. And so their lineage was correct. There was nothing improper. They were performing priestly duties in a right way according to their lineage. However, their hearts were far from God. And this is a good illustration to us. It shows us that there can be men who are pastors, ministers, elders, deacons, who hold high offices of spiritual authority within churches and congregations. And these men can have all the outward evidence that is required. They've gone to seminary. They have their Master of Divinity or their doctorate, or they've been approved by their congregation and so on to be an elder or a deacon. They could even meet the qualifications, even though very, very few today in the churches do, and the churches have modified the qualifications that God has laid down. Of course, none of that matters anymore because the church age is over, and there shouldn't even be a congregation. Not only now can we say that the deacon or the elder is not qualified to rule as deacon or elder, but the congregation is not qualified to be a congregation because God has ended the church age. So none of that matters, but it is true that historically this was the case, and these men, they had all the proper outward things going for them, and yet they were not children of God. They were sons of Belial. And this is how Satan infiltrated church after church. It is how Satan sowed tares amongst the wheat during the church age. And it's why the churches were populated with a vast majority of unsaved individuals, and the overwhelming majority of the rulership within the denominations prior to the end of the church age were already unsaved individuals. It's because of the fact that people could position themselves and get into positions of spiritual authority and not, in fact, themselves be saved. And this was the case with Eli, possibly Eli himself, but definitely the case with the sons of Eli. And it says in verse 13, and the priest's custom with the people. And the word custom is, it's a word that's only translated one other time as custom, but it's used extensively elsewhere as judgment. Time and again, it's translated as judgment. It's translated as ordinance. It's translated as three English words, manner of law. And it's translated as manner. It is a word that could refer to a legitimate law of God, a legitimate ordinance, like we find in Exodus 15:25. It's the same word. And it says in Exodus 15, verse 25, and he cried unto Jehovah, and Jehovah showed him a tree, which when he had cast into the waters were made sweet. There he made for them a statute and an ordinance, and there he proved them. So there God is the one making an ordinance, and that's the same word custom. So it can be something biblical that is a custom. You know, this is true in the New Testament too. The New Testament speaks of a custom, and it relates to the ordinance of God. But at the same time, this word is used and can be used to describe a custom of the nations that is not biblical. For example, in 1 Kings chapter 17, it says in verse 26, well, no, that can't be right. 1 Kings only goes up to verse 24. Maybe it's 2 Kings. 2 Kings. Yeah, it's 2 Kings chapter 17, verse 26. Wherefore they spake to the king of Assyria, saying, the nations which thou hast removed and placed in the cities of Samaria know not the manner of the God of the land. That's the same word, translated as custom. Therefore he has sent lions among them, and behold, they slay them because they know not the manner of the God of the land. And verse 27, then the king of Assyria commanded, saying, carry thither one of the priests whom ye brought from thence, and let them go and dwell there, and let him teach them the manner of the God of the land. And then also in verse 33, they feared Jehovah and served their own gods after the manner of the nations whom they carried away from thence. And it's the same word, manner, translated custom in 1 Samuel 2. So there's the manner of the God of the land, which would be according to the Bible, and there's the manner of the nations. And so we can't know from the word itself whether the custom is biblical and therefore good and right, or if it's It's something that the world has developed, and therefore it's not biblical. But in this case, since God, in the context of the passage we read, he finds fault with the young men that they've done this, we can know that the priest's custom with the people was not according to the law of God. They were doing things that were not according to the Bible. So this is a custom that they themselves developed. And that also helps us to realize that it is very possible for individuals in spiritual authority to develop their own custom or their own traditions, their own laws, and then they place these laws upon the hearers or the congregation, just as the priest's custom with the people became that they would take some of the flesh out of the seething pot with a flesh hook. And so in churches, customs develop. For instance, that one particular church says that the people ought not to eat meat on Friday, or on a certain Wednesday they have to get an ash placed on their forehead. And church after church has developed customs that are not according to the Bible, and these are man-made. Remember, Jesus found fault with the Pharisees because they required that people had to wash their hands and wash often. And God pointed out, look, unwashing hands doesn't defile a man. It's that which comes forth from the heart that defiles a man. See, the biblical definition of defilement or sin is what God says it is. It's not what man says it is. Whether you fail to wash your hands before dinner, no, that's not your sin. Your sin is what's coming out of your heart. And so here we find that Eli's sons, early in the days of Israel, were developing a custom. It was an ordinance that they placed upon the people, and the people were following it. And so in that, they're typifying the many traditions, the confessions, the creeds that developed throughout the church age, all through history, in which men placed upon their fellow men yokes and of burden that had to be borne. They had to obey these things. You had to confess the doctrines within the creed in order to belong to a certain church, and so on. And yet it's all just, as God sums it up, it's all sin. The sin of the young men was very great, God says. And what does it end up doing according to verse 17? As we jump ahead a little bit, it results in men abhorring. It says men abhor the offering of Jehovah. And isn't that exactly what happened in the church? How often did a child of God visit a church and visit a congregation and we just wanted to find a place? This is during the church age. We just hoped to find a place that was semi-faithful, that we could bring our families to, that we could stay and worship with a good conscience before God. And it wasn't long where we would find that they had developed an idea and elevated it. For instance, a head covering in one church that I remember. Well, you couldn't become a member of the church unless Your wife wears a head covering. Well, the Bible doesn't say that. Her hair is given her for a covering, it says. And yet they raise this to such a high degree that it became paramount. And so other doctrines far worse than that also would be found in churches and congregations, and it would just bring grief. It would bring sorrow. And maybe not to true believers, but some would develop an abhorrence of going to church, of worshiping the Lord in this place because of all the unnecessary burdens that were placed upon the people. Well, let's go back to verse 13. And the priest's custom with the people was that when any man offered sacrifice, the priest's servant came while the flesh was in seething with a flesh hook of three teeth in his hand. So there would be a large pot, and the sacrifice would be in seething. That is, it would be boiling. Or sodden is another word that seething is translated as, and it would be cooking. And so the priest's servant would come with a flesh hook. Now, a flesh hook is found in Numbers 4:11. We read a few places in the Bible of flesh hooks, but we would not be dealing with the flesh hook of Solomon's temple because that temple wasn't created yet. Probably it was a flesh hook similar to the one that they came out of the wilderness with. And in Numbers 4, verse 11, it says, "And upon the golden altar they shall spread a cloth of blue and cover it with a covering of badger skins and shall put the staves thereof, and they shall take all the instruments of ministry wherewith they minister in the sanctuary, and put them in a cloth of blue, and cover them with a covering of badger skins, and shall put them on a bar. They shall take away the ashes from the altar, and spread a purple cloth thereon. They shall put upon it all the vessels thereof, wherewith they minister about it, even the censers, the flesh hooks, and the shovels, and the basins, all the vessels of the altar." And this is describing when they would wrap it up to transport, and very carefully the sons of Kohath would be the ones who would bear it. Flesh hook was actually an instrument of ministry in which the priests were to go about their priestly duties, and the Levites, And just the priests, I suppose. And we can see how it would relate to this seething pot. And so the flesh hook with three teeth is put into it in order to pull out some meat. Now, it also says in Exodus 29, in verse 31, I want to just read some verses about seething. This is not a common word that we're used to. And actually, this whole process that they were involved in, we're not very familiar with. So it would be good for us to read some verses to get a feel for this aspect of the Israelites and their ministry. In Exodus 29, verse 31 through 34, "And thou shalt take the ram of the consecration, and seethe his flesh in the holy place. And Aaron and his son shall eat the flesh of the ram, and the bread that is in the basket, by the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And they shall eat those things wherewith the atonement was made, to consecrate and to sanctify them, but a stranger shall not eat thereof, because they are holy. And if aught of the flesh of the consecrations or of the bread remain unto the morning, then thou shalt burn the remainder with fire. It shall not be eaten, because it is holy. We see here that Aaron and his sons did eat of the sacrifice. So there's nothing wrong in itself with the sons of Eli wanting to take a portion of the sacrifice to eat or for food. That's not the sin, their sin. That's not the problem. It also says in Exodus 12, and this is the Passover in Egypt, in Exodus 12, verse 5, your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You shall take it out from the sheep or from the goats, and shall keep it up until the 14th day of the same month. And the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it in the evening. And they shall take of the blood and strike it on the two side posts and on the upper door posts of the houses wherein they shall eat it. And they shall eat the flesh in that night, roast with fire and unleavened bread, and with bitter herbs they shall eat it. Eat not of it raw, nor sodden. The word sodden is the same word seethe in 1 Samuel 2. Nor sodden at all with water, but roast with fire, his head with his legs and with the pertinence thereof. He shall let nothing of it remain until the morning, and that which remaineth of it until the morning he shall burn with fire. So here again in the first Passover, the sacrificial animal was to be consumed. And notice it was not to be eaten raw, but roast with fire. Now also, I'd like to turn to Ezekiel chapter 46 and verse 20, and then 23 and 24. Ezekiel 46:20 says, then said he unto me, this is the place where the priests shall boil the trespass offering and the sin offering, where they shall bake the meat offering, that they bear them not out into the utter court to sanctify the people. Verse 23, and there was a row of building round about in them, round about them four, and was made with boiling places under the rows round about. Then said he unto me, these are the places of them that boil, where the ministers of the house shall boil the sacrifice of the people. Now, again, this is Ezekiel's temple, which actually never was a literal temple. This whole temple spoken of in the last chapters of Ezekiel is a spiritual temple. But still, God uses language that is very similar to the actual temples of Solomon or Zerubbabel, or even the tabernacle of witness that was in the wilderness. And we see there was a place of boiling the sacrifice. So that there's nothing wrong with that, that the sacrifice was being seethed in a pot. By the way, I don't think we can fully understand it, but we can maybe get a little bit more familiar with the language of Zechariah 14, where it says in verses 20 and 21, in that day there shall there be upon the bells of the horses holiness unto the Lord, and the pots in Jehovah's house shall be like the bowls before the altar. Yea, every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness unto Jehovah of hosts. And all they that sacrifice shall come and take of them, that is, take the pots, and seethe therein. And in that day there shall be no more the Canaanite in the house of Jehovah of hosts. Now we have a, at least I do, a better physical image of what is being discussed in Zechariah 14 in these verses. It's speaking of a sacrifice using a pot, and the pot would be in the temple, and they would take the sacrificial animal and seethe it, put it in water, and put fire to the pot. And so that just was a little bit helpful to me, and I thought I'd share that. It could open up those couple of verses maybe in the future. Well, let's go back to 1 Samuel 2. In 1 Samuel 2, in verse 13, and the priest's custom with the people was that when any man offered sacrifice, the priest's servant came while the flesh was in seething, with a flesh hook of three teeth in his hand. All right, so this is fine. There's nothing wrong, no sin that we can see so far. And then verse 14, and he struck it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the flesh hook brought up, the priest took for himself. So they did in Shiloh unto all the Israelites that came thither. Also, before they burnt the fat, the priest's servant came. Now, that's the second time we're reading the priest's servant came. It was not the Hophni and Phinehas themselves, but their servant. And this servant sounds more like an enforcer than someone who would be about the Lord's business. But, well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time tonight. We'll have to get into this a little bit more tomorrow night, Lord willing. We'll stop here for now. And if possible, please join us once again as we continue the study in the book of 1 Samuel.
You've been listening to eBible Fellowship's Chris McCann with his continuing studies into the book of 1 Samuel. These studies are heard every Monday through Friday night at this very same time over Pal Talk, over Skype, over eBible Fellowship's webcast audio, or over the phone. Lord willing, we'll have another Bible study for you tomorrow night into the book of 1 Samuel. And until then, may the Lord's perfect will be done. Good night.